The next case on calendar this morning is case number 60776, Clark County v. State Board of Equalization. Before we get underway, I wanted to note on the record that two of our colleagues are not here today. They will listen to the oral arguments and participate. They are unavoidably unavailable to be here in person today, and they send their regrets, but they're participating in the decision. Mr. Johnson, are you ready to proceed?
Mr. Johnson, I can tell you one thing I'm interested in from both counsel, thinking about this issue. It's a very intriguing issue and how to deal with it, but I'm interested if the record shows the history of how this taxation's been done since associations came into existence, you know, 40, 30 years ago, whenever it happened, especially in Clark County. They have a lot of them, and how they taxed land, you know, in an association, common area, like park-type property, how they tax swimming pools, rec rooms, and all that over the last 30 years or so like that. So I'd be interested in that just as background, you know, like that. And I realize we'll get to Mineral County and some of the other issues that are up today.
And okay. Do you want to reserve time?
Yes. I would like to reserve some rebuttal time, 5 minutes if possible.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I'm not sure how much is in the record. That's the thing.
But well, if it's not in the record, then forget it. But I mean, I'm just saying if it is.
I think that what we do have in the record is the Sun City case, and there was a change in the way things were done after that case. Before that case, HOA or homeowner associations were pretty much done like anyone else, except for, you know, the grass strips, things that obviously had no value, sidewalks, stuff like that. But after that case, the assessor started to, because that case involved the restrictions on the land and how you value land that has restrictions on it, after that case, the assessor started to set the land value, the underlying land for all of these improvements at zero, basically. So in this case, that's what he did. There was no assessment on the land, and he was only looking at the improvements. And the Sun City case didn't really address the question of what you do with improvements, so that's been done under the statutes and regulations by Marshall and Swift, which is a tax service, which tells you you look at the size of the building, what it's made out of, et cetera, to determine the replacement costs. And then take the statute says you take depreciation at a set rate off the top of that. So that's the way it's been done since the original Sun City case, and that's what was done in this case.
I'm just curious what your thoughts are. If there's no market value, let's say for like the Sun City rec center pool area, whatever's out there, I mean, you can't sell it. I mean,
right.
It belongs to the association. It's something that's permanently dedicated. The association's going to have to pay for it to keep
right.
the maintenance and things like that. So it has no market value whatsoever.
And I think that
well, what's your thoughts on that?
That was mainly addressed in the rec center's case out of Arizona,
mm-hmm.
which said, you know, we recognize that this may not have a market value because it can't be sold because it's so tied up. I mean, you'd have to get all of the homeowners to vote to sell it, and it's got all these restrictions that can only be used for their benefit and the benefit of their invitees and whoever the association wants to come in there. I would like to point that out, that the board made a finding that it was restricted only to the homeowners, and that's not correct. They have a right to use it, but it's not restricted just to them. The HOA could rent that out to somebody else if they wanted to. So it's technically not that was an error in the facts. But as the rec center's case said, you know, the fact that there's probably not going to be a buyer for this because of the way it's tied up doesn't mean it has no value. That it had value when they built it. They didn't build it for, you know, just as a piece of junk that nobody wanted. They built it because it had value, and the homeowners and the HOA retain that value. But the problem is that the way the statute is set up, there's only three ways to get it value. And that's you either have to look at the income, which is a nonprofit, so there is no income, or you have to look at the comparable sales. Well, nobody's out there selling HOA rec centers to anybody else. So that leaves you with just one thing you can look at, and that's the cost, less depreciation. And not only does the statute say that, but the State Board of Equalization in their regulations interpreting the statute in NAC 361.631 list those same things, the amount of capitalized income, the value of the land, plus the depreciated replacement cost of any improvements, and prices paid in comparable transactions. So what the assessor's always done, and is continues to do, unless you tell us otherwise, is we look at the cost, because that's the only way you can get, and this, and HOA isn't the only one that has this situation. There's other situations where you have a special purpose building that really is only of value to the owner, but it has a lot of value to the owner. They wouldn't have built it if it didn't have any value to the owner. And the board kind of got sidetracked on this marketability question, and we're saying, well, nobody's going to want to buy this because they can't, they're not going to be able to turn around and make a profit on it. But that's not the point. The point is it has value, even if you could never make a profit on it.
Well, how do you tax, like, churches and synagogues and mosques? And
well, they're all exempt, so that's not an issue.
Okay.
But I would assume that they would also be a special use if they were taxed, and you would look at what it costs because it has that value to the owner. They wouldn't have spent $100 million building that church. They didn't think it was worth $100 million. And so that's the only thing you can look at. They're not going to sell it, and they're not going to try to make money off of it, but it still has value to them. So that's where the Rick Centers case, I think, ended up, saying, you know, we recognize that you're not going to be able to sell this, but that doesn't mean that that $100 million you spent building it has evaporated. And then the other place where the state board went wrong was they, Member Marnell in particular, said, well, I just believe that all of this value is transferred out to the homeowners, and it's now in the value of their homes. Well, in the previous Sun City case, the court ruled that was not true, that the value of the buildings and such owned by the HOA had nothing to do with it. It might make your home more valuable because there's something there, but it doesn't diminish the value of the property itself. So they erred by going off in that direction and said, well, you know, we it has value. It's got to have some value. It costs $20 million or whatever to build, but it's all transferred out to these homes. And that's just not the case. I mean, the homes have their own independent value, and the rec centers and all of the structures have their own independent value. And you look at them separately, and you don't transfer value back and forth between them. That was addressed in the previous case. It's pretty much res judicata as far as that goes.
How do we balance the value versus restriction?
The restrictions on the use, I mean, I think that's pretty clear also in the previous case. They only looked at NRS 361.2271A, which talks about land value, and that's all they ever talked about. And they never got to the improvement value, which has a totally different way you get at that. Under 2271B, you get at that by looking at the cost of replacement less depreciation. So, and also, I mean, if you think of land, if it's just a piece of empty land, the value very much has to do with what you can use it for. If it's land that's zoned for a garbage dump and that's the only thing you can use it for, it has probably no value. But if it's zoned as a hotel, it has a lot of value. Well, in this case, these are rec centers. And I don't think that makes it have zero value or full value, although the assessor set the value of the land at zero. I guess they just didn't want to fight about it.
In the Sun City case, we talked about looking at, in essence, kind of usage in terms of the restrictions.
Right.
Are you looking at it in terms of, can it be rented out? Is it exclusive just to the membership of the association? Do we look at that to offset value?
Well, in this case, although the board held that it was exclusive just to the homeowners, that's not true. They can rent it out. So I think that militates that it has some value. And also, you were only looking at land in that case. There wasn't any discussion about improvements, how you got to the improvement value. And the land isn't impacted by how it can be used. But the improvements, I mean, the improvements are there because that's what the owner wanted. It's not that he wants to change it to something else, and therefore it should have some different value because it's something else. It is what it is, and it should be valued as what it is. And it's a rec center or whatever it is, and it costs $20 million. And that's the only statutorily or regulatorily authorized value in this case. It's the only value anybody brought forward that complies with the law. And Barta and Bax make that pretty clear, that the state board or the assessor, nobody else, can go out and make up some rule or go look at some handbook that's not been authorized and say, oh, here's the value. We've decided it's this. And what they did here is kind of outrageous, because even the taxpayers came in saying, well, we think it's worth $10,000 a parcel. And when they were done, they said, we think it's worth $500 a parcel. Just pulled a number out of the air.
Well, that's not necessarily the case here. They actually considered Arizona's approach, and there was an indication that the chairman indicated that it was standard in the industry, and it wasn't pulled out of thin air.
Well, yeah, if you decide that it has no value, that's what you, instead of saying
normal,
zero,
normal
you say
value.
500.
Correct.
But Arizona is a little bit different because they now have statutes that fix the value, basically, on these kinds of properties, whereas Nevada doesn't. They say we still value them the same as everybody else. And even after your last case, the golf courses that involve golf courses, Nevada now has a statute that says how you specifically value the land on golf courses. But the buildings are still valued as improvements. They didn't set some set value that you can only charge no more than $500 or whatever. I think it's $2,000 an acre for golf course land. But isn't
that a significant burden for us to find that determination was clearly erroneous and unsupported by what was presented at the hearing? They had all kinds of considerations that they discussed.
Well, how do we get there? Well, the problem is, if you look at their decision, it says we find that there's basically it's not marketable, and that was the basis of their decision.
Yeah.
But that's not the basis of how you find value. You can't say it's not marketable, therefore it has no value. That's not the way you do it. And the Rec Center's case makes that very clear, that what you do is you look at the three statutory methods, and the same three methods there are in the regulations, and they didn't use any of those. In fact, Member Marnell went through and listed them off and says, we don't have any of that, we don't have any of that, and we don't have any of that. So I'm going to do something else. But he was wrong because they did have the cost approach, and they just blew that off and said, even though we have this statutorily authorized method right in front of us and we have nothing else, I'm going to say this has no value.
So that's what makes this determination clearly erroneous.
Yes, and it's in violation of law, and it doesn't follow the facts because they stated right in the decision that the only people that can use it are the homeowners, and that's not true.
Are you arguing that this presents a question of statutory construction that we reviewed de novo?
Yes.
Okay. So you're not agreeing that it's a clearly erroneous standard?
Well, I think it's both. You've got the statute that they've misinterpreted, and they say, well, it says may, so therefore we don't have to follow the three. We can do anything we want. And also that they've made mistakes in that they've misconstrued the facts, and they've said that only the homeowners can use it when that's not true. And they've misapplied the law in this case because they basically said, well, we don't really have anything under that those three ways. So we're going to do something else, and we're going to ignore that. But they did have something under those three. They made a mistake.
So your point is the sole evidence of record is cost
approach. That's the only
reason. And there was nothing on comparable sales or income.
Yes.
Capitalized income.
Mr. Johnson, let's assume we agreed with you on that argument that they could use cost as part of it. This project is probably 20 years old or whatever. And it probably has a lot of deferred maintenance like most buildings do at that age. Is that a factor to be taken into consideration as far as cost, or are you saying it's just replacement costs for
it? Replacement costs, less statutory depreciation. It's all been depreciated. I think it's 1.5% a year for whatever, 20 years.
So they would get the credit of that.
And I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Mr. Johnson, before you sit down, and I'm going to chew into your time, but I'd like to hear, before you sit down, your position as the Mineral County.
Okay. I was going to do that in rebuttal since that's his appeal, but I can do it now if you'd like. Mineral County is controlling. I mean, it's pretty clear it's controlling, and I think was correctly decided. If you look at the statute, 361.420, the other side relies upon, that's basically a tax refund statute. And it's always been a tax refund statute, and the fact that it now applies to State Board of Equalization appeals, was added in the 70s, but that statute goes back way before then. And that's why all the restrictions are in there, that you have to pay under protest and that you have to do, make your installment payments on time. None of that has anything to do with the government because it was that statute has nothing to do with the government. It's about the taxpayer. Either they follow that and get a refund, or they don't follow that and they can't get a refund. But the government has a right to appeal under 233B, which says if you file within 30 days after the administrative decision, you have a right as a party to take an appeal. So, and I think stare decisis requires you to find that. And I think it would be terrible public policy to let the state board be the final word on all these cases. They can totally mess up the facts, ignore the law, and do whatever they want, and nobody could do anything about it. So that's my position on that. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jim Sousa. I'm here today representing the Sun City Summerlin Community Association and Mr. and Mrs. Poster, members of the association. The state board decision should be affirmed because it rested both on facts that were presented to it and because the board fulfilled its constitutional obligation to equalize property. After 3 years of litigation involving developer-owned property that had yet to be developed, the county and state boards had finally established a body of law that allowed for vacant land within these subdivisions that was dedicated for common area usage, trails, parks, schools, reservoirs, police stations, all to be given significant discounts of value, 85% off the original value as if it were valued for commercial or residential use. Once the buildings were actually established on those parcels, the state board and county boards both ruled that they would have nominal values because now any uncertainty as to whether those parcels would in fact be used for these common areas was removed once the
council, you mentioned nominal value. Where is that talked about in the statute, and how do you define nominal value?
Your Honor,
as we look at a statewide approach to this issue.
Thank you. Nominal value is not listed in the statute as a value. However, the value that's determined by the assessor's office, taxable value, is always tested against a full cash value. And a full cash value under NRS 361-227 paragraph 5 is determined by the county and state boards based on their experience in the market. When we litigated the cases involving vacant land, the issue simply was, is this the same value as property available for commercial use? The answer was no, because of your decision in Summerlin saying that the restrictions on use from the development agreements and the CCNRs resulted in lesser values, and the board set those lesser values at 15% of market. But once they were then fixed as improved common areas, so we couldn't change them at that point, then they had nominal values. And the reason why they had nominal values is because they became neighborhood amenities. And those neighborhood amenities were used by the developer to entice homeowners into signing contracts so they could build their homes for them.
You identified in what you were putting forth their experience. What experience did this board have? Because the record seems to be without reference to that experience, since this number, at least if I take Mr. Johnson's word, they pull the number out of the air.
That's not accurate, Your Honor. They
tell
didn't pull the number
out of
the air. The county and state boards had been deciding appeals based on developer-owned properties for a number of years. And 3 years before this decision, they had simply relied on the assessor as it was at full value. But as the appeals went forward and the boards issued their decisions, and those were cases that I was involved with, and I gave testimony to the boards about those cases to remind them of what they were, we established finally a rule that said improved common area parcels had nominal values. And the board then asked for further proof of this, and we provided it. And that was in the parcel that we gave the aerial picture from, and that's found on page 16 of the record.
Is that consistent with the statutes and the regulations that address full cash value of improvements being depreciated replacement cost in the regs and cost of replacement less applicable depreciation and obsolescence in the statute? That's, I think, the trouble that we're having.
Sure.
The statute doesn't have nominal value in it. It has this cost issue, and we don't see anything else in this record.
Okay. Excellent question, and I appreciate it. The structure is built that, as you noticed in the Baxton-Barta decisions, the assessor's requirement to determine initial taxable value, and they have to use methodologies for doing that, including the replacement cost approach for improved properties. Statute then allows 1.5% depreciation per year. At that point, if nothing else happens, that's the value that is then final and taxes are paid. However, if the taxpayer protests that and follows all the procedures necessary, the burden falls upon the taxpayer to prove that there's some lower value than that taxable value. And the statutes lay out the ways that you could possibly do that. Now, the statutes are not all-inclusive. They're representative. And the statutory language says that you may use comparable sales income or the cost approach. You may use any other methodology. In these prior cases, we simply argued that there were legal impairments on the property. Here were development plans. These parcels are going to be parks. And the boards found, without any comparable sales, income, or cost approach, that these, in fact, were diminished in value. The sale of the property on the date of valuation does not fall within one of those three categories, and yet is relied upon by the county and state boards as evidence of value. The owner's opinion as to value similarly is relied upon by those. You may use comparable sales. You may get a full appraisal. But if you actually look at the assessor's argument in this case, they state it really doesn't matter what you did. You could use all three of those methodologies, and the value that you determine is still wrong because the assessor's value is correct. And that's the inconsistency that we pointed out in our brief. Even though they mandate under the statute one of the three requirements was necessary for the state board to decide the case, in the next breath they say, but that would have been irrelevant anyway because our value is the only value that could have been relied upon. I also want to clarify something about cost approach. When the assessor states that they did a cost approach, that's not quite accurate. A cost approach in the appraisal world is the replacement cost of the property less any applicable depreciation and obsolescence. And applicable depreciation and obsolescence are the key terms there. You refer to deferred maintenance and things like that. Sometimes when the assessor does replacement cost less 1.5%, it grossly overvalues the property based on its current state. Sometimes it undervalues it. If it undervalues it, there's no appeal. If it overvalues it, the shift is to the property owner to prove up that it overvalues the property. So when the assessor stands up and says, we did a cost approach, they did a cost approach to determine a taxable value based on the statute. They did not determine a market value for the property based on cost. That's a different animal. And it would take into required obsolescence. And obsolescence for property like this would be almost total. Because
is there evidence of record on obsolescence in this case?
There's no evidence from an appraiser that says this property would have obsolescence to render it to a value. There are later appeals that there is an appraisal on, but it's not in this record. So in this situation, the State Board had before it this history of litigation, cases that they had decided, and the fact that these amenities within planned communities should have nominal values. Because as everybody recognizes, you don't build these amenities just simply to stand alone. You build these amenities as an enticement in your sales office to get people to order houses from you so you can develop the subdivision. And there's 7,800 homes in the Sun City Summerlin area, so they have a number of these amenities. Now, and importantly, as we noted in our brief to the State Board, there are also two golf courses, and there are two little restaurant snack shacks there. Those are open to the public. Those are, in fact, valued by the assessor at full value based on income. And those we didn't protest. These are the clubhouses. These are the amenities that the members use for their recreational swimming pools, tennis courts.
Now, council indicated that that isn't strictly for the homeowners, that it's available to the public as well.
There's no evidence in this record as to that. In a later case, and this is important, in a later case, I had asserted that these were exclusive use for the homeowners. I then checked after the state board hearing in the case for the year following this one and asked, is that really true? And they said, it really is true, except if somebody really wanted to have one of our clubhouses for their granddaughter's wedding reception, we would probably rent it out to them for the evening, but nobody comes along and does that. These are really for the residents of the community.
But it would have to be linked to a resident who...
That was my understanding from them, that you couldn't walk in off the street and say, I drove by, it's a beautiful facility, I'd like to have my daughter's reception there, and they'd say, sure, just $5,000 a night. It just doesn't happen.
Could you address the standard of review for me as well? Do you agree with council that this is de novo review?
I do not. When the state board interprets a statute, for instance, an exemption statute, is this particular item exempt because it qualifies as a church? I think that kind of a legal determination then gets a de novo review. What they're trying to do here is say, well, they have to look at statutes in doing their job, and therefore this must be, in fact, a legal determination and therefore a de novo review. They always have to look at statutes in doing their job, the most important one of which is the taxable value shall not exceed full cash value. And really, at the end of the day, that's all that they're doing. And they do it for hundreds of taxpayers that come before them every single state board session. So this case is a little unique, but it is just a plain vanilla valuation appeal. And at the time that the board heard this, they had before them the example where the assessor conceded, we put a nominal value on this clubhouse, common area, that's in the Inspirata neighborhood, that I, of course, knew about because I did the appeal that got it to that value. And we pointed that out as, so why is it then if it's owned by the community association, several million dollars, but if it's owned by the developer, while he's still building houses, only $500? Something is wrong here. Something is unequal here. And that's just not appropriate. It has to be equal. So we produced value in the CC&Rs that there were restrictions placed on the properties to use. We showed them the Sun City case, the rec center's case from Arizona, and as a result, they knew that this is something that's going to affect the value of property. And then we told them that here's an example of one that's already being done that way. And after this discussion, they came to the conclusion, as they did on multiple other cases, as to a value. And when that's done, then I think the abuse of discretion, or is there substantial evidence, is probably substantial evidence is the standard to be used.
Okay. Mr. Souza, can I ask you this? We'll go to the City of Hawthorne case that you've raised that argument. And I realize three of our current justices didn't have a chance to participate in that decision.
Which case is that, sir?
City of Hawthorne, the
Mineral County.
Mineral County, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Paul, you had me going.
Hawthorne's Mineral County, I apologize. Realizing your argument that that was a split decision and three of our current justices didn't participate, under our doctrine of stare decisis, though, shouldn't we apply that precedent?
Sure. First, I will agree with Mr. Johnson. It's on all fours. I mean, there's no way to distinguish this case from that one. I think that it's always a good idea to look at what you've done in the past and consider whether that's the appropriate thing to have done. I would note that this court in 2006, in the case of Nevadans for Nevada versus Beers, overruled the decision just 3 years old in Gwynn versus Engel, where it said that the procedural requirements in the state constitution must yield to the substantive requirements. And that case was only 3 years old, and that was a 6-1 decision, with the reversing being 7-0. Some members of the same court were on both. Mm-hmm. So this court does do that. The thing that I would ask you to do is to evaluate my arguments on Mineral County, and one of the arguments that I think is really important is the property tax statutes are laid out in a fairly simple form because a lot of times you don't have lawyers representing people on property tax appeals. So they have to be laid out in a fairly easy-to-follow form for just people to read. And under 361.410, titled Judicial Review, it comes at the end after all the state board proceedings have concluded. And in paragraph 1 of that section, it states that the taxpayer can appeal to court, but it has to appeal from a final decision of the state board. So you can't just get your valuation notice in December and then go off and file a lawsuit. You have to wait and go through the whole process, meeting all the deadlines, and finally appeal from the state board decision. Importantly, in paragraph 2, it then states that the tax commission and the Department of Taxation have the right to sue and be sued and be represented by the attorney general in any proceeding from the state board. And it goes on to say, but the burden of proof remains with the taxpayer to prove that the value that was established, and this is important, by the taxation department, by the commission, or by the state board, is the wrong value. Now, is it an accident to think that the legislature thought this through and said there are four possible parties in a state board proceeding, and three of those parties they gave specific authority to in paragraphs 1 and 2 to appeal, but they left out the assessor? It's not an accident. They meant to leave out the assessor. And the reason why they meant to leave out the assessor is because in this process, by the time we get to the end of the state board, the assessor's already had three bites at the apple. They get to set the initial value for all the property, and if you don't appeal it timely or properly, that's the final value. If you do appeal it timely or properly, you have to go to the county board where the burden's on you to produce evidence as to why it's too high. And if you get to the state board and you do the same thing and you win, the assessor's had a couple opportunities to defend their value. Because state board values by statute are only good for 1 year, you only get 1 year use. I could come back the next year with the same decision on the same parcel and say I get the same thing and say, no, you don't. Prove to us the value is different. This is not binding precedent. It's just a determination between the parties which is good for 1 year and good for those two parties, and that's it. So this fear that they had in Mineral County that the State Board was going to go rogue, interpreting state taxing statutes and applying to thousands of other people, it just doesn't happen. They rarely interpret any statutes except for exemption statutes. They usually just find what the full cash value of something is, which is like beauty in the eye of the beholder. And it's only good for 1 year. And after that, you're done, and you have to go back.
Isn't there a cap on the property taxes and how much they can be raised, though? Was it 8%?
Well, it's less than that. Now it's 4.2.
4.2, okay.
Counsel, you talked about the experience of the board.
Sorry.
And I was thumbing back through because it just kind of caught me. They threw out a whole bunch of numbers, and at different points people identified that they were making it up. And the final resolution, there wasn't a basis of how he got to the $500 mark. Would you re-comment on that based upon the record that we have before us?
You may answer.
Okay. The answer, Your Honor, is that after a lengthy discussion of what the value should be, and nobody was going to $19.4 million, it was going to be something substantially less. The idea was, well, what's the number? And in an interest of purity, the only appraiser licensed on the board, the chairman of the board, said, look, guys, if you all believe this is a nominal value, and that's what we've heard after 2.5 hours of discussion here, then it's $500. And he said, I'm an appraiser, I appraise property, and it would be $500. So the board did exactly what they were supposed to do, draw upon their past experience to determine a value for property that was brought before them on appeal. Could I just address your question real fast? Maybe?
It's up to the chief.
Yes.
The tax cap is only computed after the value is set, and the rise in taxes may be guided by a different statute. So in a falling market, the tax cap has no applicability. And as the assessor's office often beats me over the head, we're not here to talk about taxes. We're just here to talk about value.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I guess I'll go back to the record. I mean, the record is devoid of evidence that supports the value. Here is a reference to Inspirata. It's my understanding that that project was not complete and that the assessor put a zero value on the land and they had not yet assessed the full value of the property because it was under construction. The evidence of he talks about, well, what about depreciation and obsolescence? There was nobody put anything in the record about depreciation or obsolescence. The board didn't rely on it. They knew there was nothing in there. They didn't even pretend to rely on any of the statutory bases to get the value. They just said, we think the value is transferred out to the homes. We don't think it's there anymore, so we're going to set it at zero or whatever as close to zero as we can get. And that's not what the law says. That's not what the law requires. If this had been a private club, and the people all got together and formed a club and said, we're not going to let anybody in but us and our friends, that doesn't mean that that club has no value. The fact that it's owned by an HOA doesn't change anything. If the state was coming in and saying, we want to condemn this property because we want to use it for something else, they wouldn't be standing here arguing, it's only worth $500 a parcel. That's all we want. The board just went amok. This has been going, HOA's been, may I have just 1 minute?
Yes.
HOAs have been assessed for many years, and there's never been a problem until all of a sudden the board decides this particular board and not previous boards, because it's been in front of previous boards that did not follow this pattern. This particular board said, we don't think you could sell it. We think the value is transferred. That's it. We're not going to give any value to this. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of other HOAs that are standing in line to get the same treatment. Thank you.
Thank you. This matter will stand submitted and will be in recess until the next call of the court. I want to thank counsel for both sides for the excellent job on the briefs and arguments.